Well, good evening. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, the management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and well, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please don't call in unless we specifically ask for calls, because we have this with us on the line, certainly one of my favorite guests, from Raleigh, North Carolina, Dr. Dennis Cuddy. And Dr. Cuddy has actually taught at the university level. He's testified before Congress. He worked in the Department of Education under the Reagan administration, and well, he's certainly one of my favorite researchers, and he goes through my newsletters, and boy, if there's anything wrong there, he sure lets me know, and I appreciate it. He actually does a great deal of research on his own, and we carry a number of the books that he has written. I wish we had all of them. Some of them are out of print, but those that we do carry are excellent. We'll tell you a little bit more about that later, but right now, without further ado, Dr. Dennis Cuddy, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, of course, it's getting pretty late back there in Raleigh, but we're going to be talking about the articles that you posted up on newsviews.com. And for our listeners, if you'd like to read what Dr. Cuddy's been writing recently, you can go to newsviews.com, and there's a special section there, the Dr. Dennis Cuddy section, and pull the articles up. Fascinating information that you need to have to be able to understand the tragic events that are unfolding before us. So without further ado, why don't you pick up the story?
Okay. Currently, I'm doing this series on mental health, education, and social control. And this coming Monday, part 32 of that will be up. And in addition to this series, the current one that I have up on News with Views is called Global Integration. And what's important about these aspects is in Part 32, as well as Global Integration, the title of the one that's up there now, and the previous one, Part 31, this idea of integration, integration of economies, social welfare systems, immigration, populations, defense strategies, you name it, is a key term and a key word, a key strategy. And so what I did in the current article I have up titled Global Integration is pick up on the end of Part 31 of Mental Health, Education, and Social Control, because it's a rather important statement. I had earlier said in Part 27 of the series, I quoted Council on Foreign Relations President Richard Haass. Now, let me digress just for a moment, because some of your listeners, most of your listeners, if they've heard me before, they've heard me talk about Cecil Rhodes and his secret society and Rhodes scholars like Bill Clinton. And these people always pop up in strategic locations. Well, your listeners need to appreciate that Richard Haass is also a Rhodes scholar. So it's not just by accident that he's become president of the Council on Foreign Relations. And in Part 27 of my series, I quoted him saying that nations, quote, must be prepared to cede, C-E-D-E, meaning give up, some of their sovereignty, end quote. And so at the end of Part 31, I mentioned that this just isn't some, you know, president of a CFR who happens to be a Rhodes Scholar, and, you know, therefore people may associate him with people like Bill Clinton, who are Rhodes Scholars. But this fellow was also director of the policy planning staff at the U.S. State Department under the current president, President Bush. You'll find that this often happens with individuals, that they go between administrations because, as Carol Quigley, Bill Clinton's mentor, said, you ought to be able to kick the rascals out without changing anything, and we'll pick up after the break.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest, Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and of course we're talking about how Carol Quigley, who is Bill Clinton's mentor, wrote a book called Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. On pages 1247 and 1248, as I remember, he talked about how we had to have a two-party system, but really no difference between them, so that why we could throw the rascals out every 4 years, but there would be no change in foreign and domestic policy. In other words, it's all a charade, but you've got to get the people to the polls. You've got to get them voting and thinking that they're going to influence policy, whereas the policy is...
plans of secret society. The Whitneys, who were very prominent skull and bones, big money people back in the late 1800s, also, and I put this in some of my books, developed a plan where they, according to them, they would alternate power, and the stupid public would think it has a choice, but it really doesn't. So it's not just, you know, Cecil Rhodes and his plan. These people network together. They often have common interests, whether it's skull and bones, like a George W. Bush and his father and grandfather, or a Bill Clinton, Strobe Talbot, and the Rhodes Scholar types. But in this particular case, Richard Haass is a Rhodes Scholar, as well as the current president of the Council on Foreign Relations. And when he was the head, like I said, of policy planning staff at the State Department under the current president, President Bush, he delivered a speech titled Defining U.S. Foreign Policy in a Post-Cold War World. And that was back in 2002, on April 22. And he delivered this to the Foreign Policy Association, which is something of a sister organization to the CFR. And he explained there, quote, there clearly is a consistent body of ideas and policies that guides the Bush administration's foreign policy. This coherence exists and can be captured by the idea of integration. Integration is about bringing nations together and then building frameworks of cooperation and, where feasible, institutions that reinforce and sustain them even more. Integration reflects not merely a hope for the future, but the emerging reality of the Bush administration, end quote. So this isn't just a sort of Clinton leftist Rhodes Scholar type of thing. They've kicked the rascals out, so to speak, but as you said, Dr. Stan, nothing's really changed. George W. Bush has picked right up on this, and he's got Richard Haass there, a Rhodes Scholar himself, CFR president, and continuing with this.
Hold that thought right there, please, Dennis. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Cuddy is simply talking about Richard Haass, Rhodes Scholar, president of the or chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations, who talked about how nations are going to have to begin to give up some of their sovereignty as we move towards a more equitable society. And this is really what it's all about. We have a small group of elitists who want to rule the world. And the best way to rule the world is to consolidate it. And then, of course, you control the consolidation. So pick up the story there, Dr. Cuddy.
Right, and after the quote at the end of my part 31 of my Mental Health Education Social Control series, the final statement that I write is, once the nations of the world become, quote, integrated, quote, economically and in other ways, it will not be difficult for the power elite to argue that these integrated entities should be managed by a world government. And, of course, the ultimate goal is a world socialist government.
But, of course, you know, they keep denying it. We wouldn't want to do that. We wouldn't want to unite the Northern Hemisphere. We wouldn't want to do a thing like that. You know, and, of course, they're simply lying because they know the American people don't want to give up their sovereignty anymore. The people of Europe want to give up their sovereignty, or the people of the Orient want to give up their sovereignty. But the elite believe they know what's best for us, common folks.
Absolutely, and picking up on what you just said in part 32 that will be up on newswithviews.com on Monday, I go into that, what you said, and give some further indication of that, including a secret video that George Bush sent out in the 2004 campaign. I think your listeners will find that of interest come Monday. But what I thought I'd do this time in the current article, which is titled Global Integration, is to give some specifics. Oftentimes, people talk in terms of, oh, there's a conspiracy and the goal is world government, and, you know, we'll quote David Rockefeller or Franklin Roosevelt or Colonel House or Cecil Rhodes or something like that. But people oftentimes don't see it happening around them. And so they tend to just, you know, watch their ball games and eat their pizzas and say, well, I'm going to work every morning, and, you know, it seems normal to me. So what I thought I'd do in this particular item, global integration, is show how this works. The world socialist government's the ultimate aim, and as we've talked about before, their idea is to link up regional economic arrangements and then say they have to be managed by this world government. And, of course, the region that we're talking about often today is Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. But that's sort of in the works. So that's an ongoing process. What I thought I'd do is show how it has already happened, the linkage of the U.S. and Europe. And by that I don't mean, you know, well, they're linked economically, we have trade. I thought I'd actually go through the nuts and bolts of this thing, how this works, so that your listeners will get a good idea of how it's happening, and then maybe they can understand why their own education in their own community is the way it is, why their welfare program is the way it is, why their economic situation is the way it is, and so on. It'll all sort of make sense, hopefully. But once I show how this has already been done, 98, so this is like 8 years ago, so you'll get an idea of how this is already in the works. This is ongoing, it's already been done, and it's affecting all of your listeners wherever they are. And I titled this thing the New Transatlantic Agenda because that's exactly the title of an agreement that Bill Clinton, back in December 21 of 1995, signed. And the way it goes is like this. We have things in this country that are passed in terms of legislation. Say 1994, you had school to work at the federal level, a law passed. You had another one called Goals 2000. And often people say, you know, where did this come from? Well, you know, it didn't come from just nowhere. The thing was planned. There's a background to it. And it establishes a certain regimen that would be followed and is picked up internationally. They're setting the stage for these international agreements. And so what I've done is shown how on May 18th of 1998, the White House, this is Bill Clinton, released a statement at the conclusion of what was called the U.S.-European Summit. It was in London. And they indicated that through the new transatlantic agenda created in 1995, that's that December 21, 1995 signed agreement, the U.S. and the European Union have focused on addressing the challenges and opportunities of global integration. There's that term again, just like Richard Haass used, global integration. And one part of this global integration in 95 was the agreement between the U.S. and the European community establishing, in the field of education, a cooperation program in higher ed and vocational education at the junior high and high school level, and training as well. So it's education and training. And it, like I said, it was signed December 21, and it calls for, quote, improving the quality of human resource development, transatlantic student mobility, and thus portability of academic credits, end quote. And it said, in this regard, a joint committee, U.S., Americans, and Europeans, would reach decisions by consensus. Okay, let's back up. First of all, note that term human resources, not people, but human resources. Resources have to be managed. So what they're talking about is managing people. We're referred to now as human resources or human capital or some other term that sort of reduces our humanity into a resource like timber or coal or something like that that has to be managed and controlled. And transatlantic, of course, means with student mobility that there'll be a back and forth, a back of people from Europe coming here, American students going there, and portability of academic credits. Now, if you're going to have a portability of an academic credit, it has to be recognized. There has to be some sort of standardization. So this is their idea of developing these international standards. Because they can't have people who say, well, I'm a good welder, I've had a welding training course in my high school in, let's say, Des Moines, and show up over in London, and they'll say, well, you know, how do we know? So what you have to have is some standardization that's internationally recognized, so as soon as you show up, they will accept you, or, you know, wherever you go in Europe or in the U.S. And finally, the decisions are reached by consensus. In other words, this is no longer American training, American education. It is conditioned and compromised with what the Europeans want. We are no longer totally in control of what we're doing in our local schools. I mean, you may have your child walk to school. There may be a history course. They may learn, you know, George Washington was the first president. But ultimately, these decisions, the standardization, the requirements are being driven by people at an international level between the two countries. Okay. Now, what happened was after they signed this agreement, U.S. and European Union then convened a conference, and it was called Bridging the Atlantic, People-to-People Links, and that was held a couple of years after the signed agreement on May 5 and 6 of 1997. And what they called for there, this was the next step, was, quote, thematic networks for curriculum development, and it further stated that in an information U.S., whether you want to or not, you're now obligated, you're obliged to adapt. That means change. Whatever you've got going in terms of education, training, economics, and so forth, you're going to change it to go along with this consensus with the Europeans. And it involves economic, training, and social welfare programs. So this isn't just, you know, some sort of economic initiative for trade. This isn't just some sort of education program. This involves social welfare programs, health programs. It's a total package of restructuring and change for what we've been doing in America to go along by consensus with these Europeans. Now, the conference final report noted that in the U.S., it was an organization called ACHIEVE, A-C-H-I-E-V-E. That's an organization, and it was, as they said, one of the organizations at the forefront of defining key issues in this regard and developing strategies to address them. So who was this ACHIEVE group? ACHIEVE was formed some years ago before this agreement, and it involves some leading governors as well as leading business people in the country. And I remember when it came out, a lot of this stuff was always funded by foundations. I think Pew Charitable Trust has a lot of money involved in this one. And I remember the time when they began seeing Lou Gerstner, who was head of IBM, and he literally said, we at ACHIEVE are going to make our decisions about whether we will locate or expand a factory in California or Oregon or where it is based on whether you go along with what we say. And what they were doing, ACHIEVE has been measuring and reporting each state's annual progress in establishing internationally competitive standards, not just, you know, your local control of your schools, internationally competitive standards. And as I said, the business leaders involved have indicated their commitment to consider the quality of each state's standards when making business location or expansion decisions.
Now, basically what I think our listeners must understand is that corporations like IBM and so many of our other major corporations are part and parcel of this whole internationalist movement. Going right along with our great tax-exempt foundations, their goal is to do away with national sovereignty. Everything is to be taken over by international bureaucracy, and everybody it will have nothing to do with what our duly elected representatives want. Let's say Congress votes to do things one way. Why, these international bureaucracies and agreements will say you can't do it that way. The people of Europe don't want genetically modified foods. They're being forced to accept them by the World Trade Organizations, by these other agreements, supranational organizations that do a end run around national sovereignty, whether it be the national sovereignty of the United States, whether it be the national sovereignty of Europe. World government has been a long-range plan. It began with Cecil Rhodes, of course, long before that, but Cecil Rhodes was the man who created the secret society that became the Council on Foreign Relations, and that's covered on pages 951 and 952 of Professor Quigley's book. Well, Dennis, you pick up the story there.
Sure, and oftentimes what I try to do is put things in their own words, so in case somebody doubts, you know, that the CFR was part of Rhodes' plan and what their goal is, that's easily traceable, as you said, in Tragedy and Hope, where part of the group was a circle of initiates, and then they had an association of helpers, which was semi-secret around them, and they formed what were called roundtable groups, and the CFR, as well as in England, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, were an outgrowth of the roundtable groups, and even members, such as Arthur Schlesinger and his his book, A Thousand Days, Kennedy administration advisor, Harvard professor, in his book, and he's a member of the CFR, said that these this group, the CFR, was a, quote, front group for this power elite. Same thing with Carol Quigley in Tragedy and Hope. He used the same term, a front group. The CFR is a front group for these people. So picking up on that, what you have in this particular case is the next stage was called the Partners in a Global Economy Working Group. They always have these committees or working groups, and they have skill certificates and institutionalizing cross-national learning training activities. Okay, a lot of this stuff is in edu-speak or whatever, but basically what they're saying is you're going to change your curricula. You may think you have local control over the curriculum in your school, but that's not the case. They are determined to decide what career skills are needed. What you'll probably find, and I'll digress a little here, is if your listeners are interested in education, you'll find probably wherever you are in California, wherever, that there's a workforce development board that's been established, and they're looking at your skill needs for your area in the future. And that's what's being pushed in your school. They'll probably ask your youngsters around eighth grade to choose a career path. Now, in case you object and say, well, I don't want my child locked in to, you know, being an electrician or something, they will say, and truthfully, well, you know, you're not locked in, you can change. The problem is, and this is what the German students found out, is once you go through a couple of years of whatever path track you're in, then it becomes really difficult to change and graduate on time because you have to have certain course requirements. Let's say you take, you know, your freshman and take electrician one, and then sophomore year take electrician two, and then you say, well, I don't want to be an electrician, I want to be a welder or something. Well, you know, then you've got to start all over. You've got to take welding one and welding two and so on. And so that can actually delay your graduation. And so what in Germany they found was that the youngster, once they got into a career path, they stayed in there even though they really didn't want to because they wanted to graduate on time. And so what you have here is a determination on what career skills are needed, and you have the portability of the skill certificates. So in addition to this workforce development board, what you'll probably find, and you can check this out at your local high school, you'll probably find now that your graduates either have on their diploma or on some you know piece of paper that they have a skill certificate. Now you could be college prep, but most youngsters entering school do not get a four-year college education.
Hold that thought right there, Dennis. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty and bring our other stations on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and we're covering the information he has posted up on newswithviews.com. And he's talking about this workforce education, which is being, of course, disseminated not only here in the United States, but throughout Europe. And eventually, of course, it will be disseminated throughout the world. But right now, certainly the United States and Europe. And the idea that people will be trained in certain specific trades, and they will be trained to certain specific standards so that they will be able to work in the United States or, you know, in France or Italy or Germany or because they're going to have certificates that are issued by the academic facilities, and of course they're going to say this man is to be a welder, and the thing is that you get into welding, that's what you'll do the rest of your life. It's all being planned by the bureaucracy. We need welders, we train welders. We need street sweepers, we train sweepers. We need nurses, we train nurses. You want to be a doctor? Sorry, we don't need doctors, we need nurses now, and specifically in this area. So wouldn't you like to become a nurse? Go ahead, Dennis.
Sure, that's right. And, two points then. Previously you had mentioned about, corporations and their role in all this driving it. I remember hearing, just as an aside, back in 1970s, and this was, you know, a long time ago, and I remember they looked, it was an interview in Oklahoma, I think it was Oklahoma City or Tulsa, and they were interviewing the head of Phillips Petroleum, it was called at the time. And the fellow was saying, you know, what about this, that, and the other, and the price of gasoline, and there's a gas shortage here in the 70s, and why don't you do this, that, and the other? And the head of Phillips Petroleum just looked right at him and right in the camera and said, oh, but we can't consider America We're an international company going global. A lot of their profits were coming from overseas, and the bottom line is what they cared about, and if it didn't go along with the best interest of American workers, well, that's, you know, that's just too bad.
And of course, that's why they don't see anything wrong with transferring, you know, so many of their jobs over to India, and you want to, for instance, arrange a flight on Delta Airlines, while you call in, you'll talk to a computer, and then you'll be transferred to Raj, who's over in New Delhi, or certainly somebody else over in one of the other Indian communities. And increasing our major corporations are transferring their telephone communications overseas. They're transferring many of our better jobs overseas. They're transferring our factories overseas. It is all about internationalism. It's doing away with sovereignty. It's redistribution of the wealth and the jobs and the manufacturing of the United States to other countries to raise their living standards and lower ours. And the average American just can't understand anything that's going on. It just doesn't make sense. Well, of course it makes sense. In the same way that the administration and all the administrations have refused to enforce immigration laws. They want people coming in. They want to lower the wage standards. They want to break the backs of the unions. They want to begin raising American living standards to that of the Mexican peasant. It's happening before our very eyes, and the average American has no ideas what's happening. And, of course, Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity will keep telling us that everything's all right. Why, there's nothing wrong with the Council on Foreign Relations. Just a group of people who sit around and those boring meetings, terrible boring meetings, but never mention this is a front organization for a secret society, and you want to document it, to read the book written by Professor Quigley, who was Bill Clinton's mentor, so effective that somebody bought up the publisher and destroyed the place of the first half of Tragedy and Hope. And if you don't believe that, we have an interview with Professor Quigley where he tells you that story, how they bought up his publisher, destroyed the place of the first half of his book, so the American people would never know the truth. Well, go ahead, Dennis.
Yeah, that Washington Post interviewer, after he did that, he the article that he wrote following the interview with Professor Quigley was titled, quote, "The Professor Who Knew Too Much," was the title of that. I think Quigley passed away about a year after that. And I've had a similar experience as you did with Delta. I mean, not with Delta, but I think it was Sprint Telephone Company, whatever it was. And I could clearly hear that this is a voice of someone from India, but he didn't call himself Raj. He said, "This is John." I mean, he made a big point of saying, "This is John." So that you would think it's down the street from you, or your local fellow resident there. And, there's three aspects to an economy. You have your manufacturing base, which is extremely important because it's necessary in times of hardship or war or whatever to control your own vital industries, you know, whatever widgets or airplane parts or whatever you need. Another part, I guess we'll pick up after the break.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back here with Dr. Dennis Cuddy. And, of course, we're talking about this move towards globalization, the move towards the end of sovereignty, the move towards the end of our constitutional guarantees of freedom, the end of America as we know it. And it's well on the way, ladies and gentlemen, well on the way. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and people say, well, if these things were going on, certainly we'd read about it in the newspapers or the magazines, or we'd hear about it on television, and people do not understand that Cecil Rhodes and his right-hand man, Lloyd Milner, were talking back in the, you know, in the 1890s about, you know, the importance of gaining control of the media. And, of course, many generations later, we're, what, five generations later, why, it is these people of great wealth, the disciples of Cecil Rhodes and Lloyd Milner, who today control the major media in the United States, and really, certainly here in the North American hemisphere, you didn't see, and that is how they were able to mold our minds, to create our tastes, to suggest our ideas. And they're suggested primarily by people we have never even heard of. Go ahead.
Sure. And basically, before the break, we were talking about corporations, and David Corton has a book about corporations are ruling the world. And there, they and the foundations and the big money people, for example, the CFR is an outgrowth of Cecil Rhodes' plan. You have to have money. And so J.P. Morgan put up a lot of the money for the Council on Foreign Relations operations in its early days, with his right-hand man, Thomas Lamont, and others. And originally they were going to buy up about 200 newspapers, but then they got, I think the guy's name was Sibley, they found out he was the sort of conduit. You know, he would take Morgan's money around and, you know, slip it into people's pockets. And they found out they really only had to buy up about 25 papers because all the other papers around the country would get their information from them. So what I do is I ask people today, same thing could have been done 50 years or so ago, is, well, did you hear that Woodrow Wilson said there's a power somewhere so complete, so pervasive, so interlocked, so watchful, and so forth and so on, and FDR said the financial element owns our country, and so forth, and they say, well, no, I hadn't heard that, and I say, well, why is it you think that these newspapers, the New York Times, Washington Post, and all, haven't told you about this? This isn't some, you know, wild-eyed extremist. This is the presidents of the United States. And then they get an idea that it's not just what they're told in the newspaper, but as you said, what the newspapers keep them from knowing, what they deliberately don't tell them. And so what you have, just before the break, I was saying there's three aspects to an economy. You have your manufacturing base, which we've already shipped overseas.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, as Dr. Dennis Kenny, and he says there's three elements to an economy, the manufacturing and well, we're shipping that overseas. We're closing down. Ford's going to close down a number of its major plants and move them down to Mexico, lay the people off here, and just simply shift its manufacturing base to Mexico. That's certainly General Motors doing that. The largest automobile manufacturer in China today is not Chinese Motors. It's not Nissan or one of the other. It's General Motors, the largest automobile manufacturer in China, but we can't let the American people know that as we're shutting down General Motors plants. So pick the story up there, Dennis.
So it's not just a matter of shipping, quote, jobs overseas. Oftentimes what happens is we ship our technology over there and then arbitrage the workers. We're just substituting these, you know, Chinese workers for American workers and giving them the American technology with which to undermine the American worker. And so the three aspects of the workforce, the labor force, would be your manufacturing jobs. They went started overseas a long time ago. Pretty much all of it's gone. I mean, you can't get a shirt made in the USA anymore, practically here, as well as a lot of other things. And I sometimes give that sort of humorous story about this fellow named John Smith wakes up and he turns on his radio made in Singapore and shaves himself with a razor made in Japan and puts on his shirt made in Hong Kong and so forth, and then he goes out and looks for a good paying American job and he's really surprised. I don't know why I can't find one when he's buying all the time products that have been made overseas, manufacturing. But when they went overseas, we told, well, don't worry about that because we'll have these high-tech, high-paying, innovative jobs. You know, that's where America's strength is with innovation and so on and so on. But now we find out that a lot of those are being outsourced overseas to other countries. A lot of even hospitals' x-rays are being read overnight in India, and then the results shipped back, the next morning for the doctors at Hospital X here to use. Or if they don't do that, the Bush administration is trying to increase the number of, I think it's called H-1B visas, where they actually
bring in with these special visas. And, of course, that's simply going to put, American workers out of work. And that's what it's about. American workers are going to be forced to work for less. And we're going to grind down the wage standards in America. They know what they're doing, but they can't tell the American people.
Right, and I think the Bush administration wants to almost double that number that they can get in here with these visas. And so what we're left with is the third tier of labor force, which are your service workers. And in that, we're being undercut as well. And that involves oftentimes youngsters starting out, African Americans or white or whatever, just 18 years old starting in the workforce. because, as I indicated earlier, most people who start school in the kindergarten, the first grade, do not wind up getting four-year college degrees. And so they're into some sort of occupation, welding, electrician, whatever. And in this particular case, in service industries, whether it's hotel, motel workers, or if they're in orderlies in hospitals, or beside that, grass cutters, carpet cleaners, all of these industries, what's happening is guest workers are moving in and are able to live, literally live, off of minimum wage because the contractors are getting, let's say, 10 of them and housing them in a house like a dormitory, just, you know, cramming 10 of them into a three-bedroom house so that they have to pay individually only one-tenth of the cost, whether it's a utility bill or, you know, water, whatever the bill is, electricity, that the average young person, let's say an 18-year-old American who wants to start a family, work real hard, they have to pay or bear all of that burden themselves. But these people brought in as guest workers can literally live on minimum wage when the American young American worker cannot do that. And so we're getting whacked here in terms of manufacturing jobs and high-tech jobs and service industry jobs as well. And so this is part of a long-term plan. And as I indicated, this agreement, this new transatlantic agenda, it was called, what you have is school to work was the initiatives there, as well as the national standards that we have for Goals 2000, were developed by the National Center on Education and the Economy. The fellow who's head of that is a Mark Tucker. He was in where I used to work in the federal government, and when I came, he left, and he went to this organization. It's a Carnegie product, Carnegie idea, Carnegie funded. Actually, this fellow who was governor of my state, it was his brainchild, more or less. He went up to talk to David Hamburg with Carnegie and got him to do this. But anyway, Mark Tucker was with this National Center on Education and Economy, and Hillary was on the board, and the governor of this state was on the board, and David Rockefeller Jr. was on the board, and Mario Cuomo was on. Everybody seems to be on this board. And one of the people also on the National Skills Standards Board, they're setting these skill standards, is Carolyn Warner, who used to be the superintendent of Arizona schools. And I have a quote of her back in the Arizona Republic newspaper in the 1970s, where she says that teachers are to be honored more than parents, because parents just have the children, but teachers teach them the art of living. That's that typical elitist mentality. And so what the Skill Standards Board on its website says, they're developing what's called a smart card. They had a smart cards project forum. And in there, the forum, it says, quote, the Tavistock Institute, the European Commission, are working on a feasibility study to research the effect of using smart cards in competence accreditation. The study will be carried out in the USA and parts of Europe. Now, I'm not going to go into Tavistock. We've talked about them in the past, but that's a really interesting outfit and their theories of social turbulence and John Rawlings Rees and his psychological manipulation, and said, you know, we're getting into schools and religion and we're taking them over and infiltrating them and so on. But anyway, the point is they're developing this smart card for competence accreditation. In other words, you have to be accredited. You have to go to accredited school to determine that you are now competent as a welder and electrician. And all of this is going to be stuck on this smart card that Tavistock has developed. And the project involved assessing and validating the student's skills, and it would put this information, their personal skills, on these smart cards. And what I thought was an interesting phrase is where it said these will become, these smart cards, these skill competency notations on skill card would become real passports to employment. That's the term they use. They would become real passports to employment. And so what I asked in this article that I wrote was, if without a passport one cannot enter a country, does this mean that without a skills passport one may not be able to get a job in the future? This is one of the ways that they proceed with these things. They'll attach accreditation or certification requirements, and you have to jump through certain hoops or you wind up not getting into college or not getting a job. And so in October of 1997, the Tavistock Institute and Manchester University over in England completed a final report for the European Commission. And they in there described the relevancy of, in the U.S., Goals 2000, SCANS, that's the U.S. Department of Labor's Secretary of Labor's Commission on Achieving Necessary Skills, typology with its, quote, profound implications for the curriculum and training changes that this will require, end quote. Now, let me digress, because one example I like to give of this SCANS report is this was Bill Brock. He was senator then, and, you know, the Secretary of Labor was Pam. These geniuses say is that the way you feed cows is by attaching milkers. These are milking machines. You attach the milking machine. Any of you are familiar with farming? Milkers are called the milking machines are called milkers. And so they say, these geniuses say, the way you feed cows is by attaching these milking machines to them. And these are the people who are going to decide what competencies we should have, what skills we should have in order to get these passports to employment. And so what they did was they determined what valid skill standards there would be. These they wanted these portable credentials, and they said they would be, quote, benchmarked to international standards such as those promulgated by the International Standards Organization, ISO, end quote. Now, in case you're not familiar, listeners, with ISO, that was originated back in the late 1940s, and they standardized everything, the size of cartons, the size of shipping devices, weighing machines. Everything has this ISO standard number on it. And so this, too, we're going to have benchmarked to international standards such as those promulgated by that. So now your educational standards are going to be as well. And remember, this isn't just education. This involves your social welfare programs you have to adapt that I told you about earlier. And the report summary goes on to say that, quote, there is increasing attention being focused on developing global skill standards and accreditation requirements, and there will be, quote, partnerships between government, industry, and representatives of worker organizations and a high degree of integration, there's that term again, integration, embedding skills within the broader context of economic and social activity, and specifically within the areas of secondary education, work-based learning, and local and regional economic development. And it goes on talking about the Skills Standards Board's Goals 2000, School to Work, are all coming to act as a catalyst to promote the formation of partnerships to develop skill standards. In this regard, a system like O-Net, O and then N-E-T, can be seen as the glue that holds everything together, end quote. Now, that's a long quotation, but the key words are, these are going to be international skill standards, internationally accredited. You're going to have partnerships. You may have heard public-private partnerships. It's going to be between government and industry and worker organizations. You're going to have these integrated. There's that term again, integration. They're going to embed the skills within a broader context, not just education, but the broader context of economic and social activity in your secondary education, work-based learning, and regional economic development for your region, wherever you are, the western U.S., southern U.S., whatever. And so they have to have something to hold this all together. This is a very large system. And so O-Net, it's a organization that was formed, is going to hold all this together. Now, your listeners probably, again, never heard of O-Net. You know, what's an O-Net? Well, O-Net, and I'm writing this, remember, I'm writing this as a congressional record back 8 years ago. O-Net is a new occupational database system sponsored by the U.S. Department of Labor's Employment and Training Administration. And at that time, 8-plus years ago, it was being piloted in Texas, South Carolina, California, New York, and Minnesota. And what it includes is information like, quote, worker characteristics, that's your abilities, interests, work styles, and so on, as well as, quote, worker requirements, and that's your basic skills, knowledge, and education. So this is a total package. Everything is going to be determined, accredited by consensus. You're going to have to do these to get a job. You're going to have portability of skill credentials. There is a database already in the works that has all of your records, and this whole ball of wax has been planned and organized and in the works, and most people aren't even aware of it.
And I think this is the thing. It's all incremental. They do it so slowly. We really don't understand what's happening. They have a plan. They have an agenda, and they follow it step by step. You know, who would have imagined, you know, that they would have all the rules and regulations as far as the environment is concerned, and you can't develop your land if you have a fern on it because this might be a wet zone, or you may have a snail on it. How did all of these things come about? Certainly the American people didn't vote on it. Our duly elected representatives didn't vote on it. It was all just brought in through a massive bureaucracy. And this is what they're doing. They're doing an end run around our constitutional guarantees of freedom because they're people who really don't believe in freedom. They believe in a new world order under a ruling aristocracy, and that's them, because they're so much smarter than we are. And then, of course, along with that, of course, will be the destruction of conventional Christianity and replacing it with some sort of a new type of religion. Because it all goes together. You cannot separate this move towards the one-world dictatorship under a ruling elite. And, of course, the spiritual force that energizes them. Why don't you pick up there, Dennis?
Sure. And the point I want to make is this article that I had is in Global Integration, the current one I have on News with Views. I wrote this. It was put in the Congressional Record by Congressman Henry Hyde 8 years ago. And at that same time, this example is the U.S. and Europe. But you'd have works, all your listeners are familiar with John Naisbitt. At that time, 96, he was writing Megatrends Asia. It's not just the U.S. and Europe. All of these regional economic arrangements, in this case, Naisbitt, the elite are all for this. And that you mentioned Carol Quigley in his book, Tragedy and Hope. This was not an expose in a negative sense. As far as Quigley was concerned, he had access to the, quote, secret records of these people for a couple of years in the early 60s. He got a few of them from Lord Haldane, a few from Lord Milner, and one or two other people. And when he titled his book Tragedy and Hope, he thought these people were the hope of the world. It was a positive thing. He said their importance is so great that they need to be known. He thought he was doing, you know, them a big favor by saying, look, you know, these people are great. They need credit for this, and we need to recognize their expertise and their guidance and how wonderful they are. And that's why he was able to get a hold of these, quote, secret records. It wasn't like there was an infiltrator within Cecil Rhodes' outfit saying, you know, I object to this, you know, and I'm going to expose it. Quigley was able to get these things because he thought they were wonderful. They were the hope of the world. And he just wanted to give them credit and recognition for this.
No, of course, they did not want credit and recognition.
No.
They did not publicly. The last thing they wanted was for us common folks to understand what they were up to.
That's right. But people like Sir Alfred Zimmern was, I guess, the main one funneling a lot of this stuff to him. A few of them, and Quigley didn't, you know, he didn't appreciate the fact, and Quigley later in his life sort of wised up to the fact that they didn't like what he did. But as you said, there's also a spiritual, Quigley doesn't get so much into that, but there is the spiritual element, which has been part of that. I remember the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, Henry Kissinger had worked for him in the 50s. David Rockefeller picked up Kissinger and sort of groomed him as a young Harvard PhD type. And the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, for which Kissinger worked in the late 50s, produced a mid-century challenge, it was called. And in there, they talked about the New World Order. They used that term, New World Order, and they said it wouldn't just be political, economic, and social. There would be a spiritual element to it as well. So they recognized that there is a certain spiritual aspect to this thing that they cannot allow to go forward by chance. They have to control that as well.
And, of course, when you read what Barry Goldwater wrote about the Trilateral Commission, which is sort of a little step above the Council on Foreign Relations organized by David Rockefeller, and, of course, there, Barry Goldwater recognized they not only wanted to control political and banking, but ecclesiastic, he was talking about. They wanted to control the church because they knew that was how they could control the people. Well, Dennis, why don't you go right ahead? We've got about 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program.
Okay, and that's important. Goldwater was explaining the CFR, and in this case, the Trilateral Commission, his book, With No Apologies, was Barry Goldwater's book, and he used that term, ecclesiastical. And remember I mentioned before about Tavistock and John Rawlings Rees, and in one of the parts of my mental health education and social control series, I quote, in fact, one of the early parts, John Rawlings Rees from a mental health journal that he authored an article in, and he just flat out said, you know, we are getting into the church, the religious aspect of life, as well as education. And he says, we're already in there. We've infiltrated, he was a psychiatrist, we've infiltrated them, and we're going to control and manipulate them. And so early on, they were already in there, and they had cooperative elements. You had people like John Foster Dulles, who would later, after 1940, when Reese is writing this, I think it was 40, maybe 41, who was part of a, Dulles was part of what's called the Universal World Brotherhood. He would go to these syncretistic interfaith conferences, and Dulles and the rest of them, together with what was called the National Council of Churches, and it had been the Federal Council of Churches and part of the World Council of Churches, were using these terms. I mean, they wrote it up, and I have it in some of my books in Time Magazine, where they're talking about we need a world government, you know, we need this common faith type of thing that John Dewey had written about in 1934. John Dewey authored that book, A Common Faith, where he said dogmatic religions would have to surrender because they were developing this this philosophy, faith, ethic, morality, whatever you want to call it, that we all have in common. And so this has really been in the works for a long, long time. And it's, as you said, a spiritual element. And at the heart of it, behind a lot of these things, is this sort of occult aspect to it that Alice Bailey had written about, and Annie Besant before her, and Krishnamurti, who was supposed to be their new, you know, guiding light, the reappeared Christ, and so on. And before her, Madame Blavatsky, and it goes on back. And it linked up with political aspects to it. The Illuminati was trying to undermine not only a kingly authority, but religious authority as well. So there's been an attack, an assault upon religion for many, many years. It takes different forms. Some would call it a new age, and others would call it a watering down of traditional biblical teaching. But spirituality is a really important part of it. And in one of my upcoming articles, I'll put about how there's been a call for a United Nations of Religions. If you think the UN has done, you know, a bad job.
Hold that thought there, Dennis. We'll be right back in just a moment to wrap up the program. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest has been Dr. Dennis Kenny, and we could go on for about another 3 hours. But, of course, we're going to have to call an end to this. And, Dennis, thank you so very much for being with us. Appreciate it, and hope we can get a pamphlet on mental health screening. We carry his book, Cover Up, and certainly we recommend his material, A Road to Socialism, which we carry, timeline to a new world order for education, an extensive chronicling of this whole long-range plan by an elite, a very wealthy and powerful elite. Behind them are the powerful spiritual forces, which I describe in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. If you have not yet read it, let me recommend it to you. That's Brotherhood of Darkness. And, of course, you can get the book, you can get the DVD, you can get the VHS, you can get an audio tape, or you can get them together in the Brotherhood of Darkness special. We hope that many of you will want to get the information and certainly get Dr. Cuddy's information as well, and then help us disseminate the truth out across America. I do want to mention that we do carry the Berkey products. If you need a big Berkey or Berkey Light and you get one through us, why, you'll get a free video or four-tape set that we produced. And then, of course, I want to mention my talk on World Revolution, because it will give you insight into how it is that very, very powerful people have been behind this whole movement to bring about world communism and world socialism, financing these things so we would have an enemy to rally the people against. And, of course, the classic book on that is Foundations, Their Power and Influence, written by Rennie Wormser, who was the counselor for a congressional committee that investigated the great tax-exempt foundations, Rockefeller, Ford, Carnegie, almost 50 years ago. And they found they were financing communism and socialism. And, of course, if you want to bring it up to date, we carry the book Importing Revolution, going into how the Ford Foundation is funding this whole illegal immigration movement, LULAC and Maldavan, so many of these groups of Mexican nationalist organizations that are helping the illegal immigrants. Why? Why? Because, of course, they want to change our culture. They want to make us a multilingual, multicultural society. They want to destroy America because their loyalty is not to the United States, but to this internationalist dream. And behind that are the powerful forces that energized Henry Ford. And that's all covered in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and explains why Henry Ford financed the Nazis, because the rationale was they were anti-communist. But then Henry Ford financed the communists and built a massive plant, a Ford Motor plant at Gorky in Russia. So why would Henry Ford finance both the communists and the Nazis? Well, you'll find the answer in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. And, well, we're out of time. This is the time when we need to remind you Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. We hope many of you will want to join the Radio Liberty family. And remember our webpage, radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Our telephone number, 1-800-54